Hey, everybody, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Jam-packed episode for you, as always. We're going to open up with Newmarker's newsmakers. Chris Newmark and I will unpack an unbelievably busy news week in medtech. Then we'll hear our FOMO episode, our FOMO interview between Jim Hamaran, the managing editor of Medical Design and Outsourcing, and Ken Charhut, the CEO of Foldax. They connected at Device Talks West. And then finally, Chris Newmarker talks with Dr. Alan Cheng. He's the chief medical officer at Medtronic's cardiac rhythm management business. And they'll talk about Link and a whole bunch of other great technologies and explore where this space is going. This entire episode is sponsored by our very great friends at Resonetics. Managing editor Kayleen Brown will bring them into the episode and share with you a great conversation. So that's a lot going on. Happy to have you here at Device Talks Weekly. We do have our final Device Talks Tuesdays on January 9th. Please go to devicetalks.com to register. All right, let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Marker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. Like, man, you know, it's we're talking on Thursday morning, and we got our first really good freeze like early. Like,
it's, okay, yeah,
it was a balmy -9 today at the bus stop. Kids get on the bus fast when it's -9.
We got our little snowstorm here. We got, not a snowstorm. We got like 1.5 inches, but it was the sloppy frozen stuff.
I remember we were saying Boston was going to get a nor'easter, but, you know, I remember that's always like living on the East Coast.
It's always funny. Like on Monday morning, it was like 6 to 8. And then by like Monday, 2 o'clock, it was like, well, maybe 1 to 2.
Right.
All right. Well, fine. So the later one was more accurate. So yes, winter is here, Chris Newmarker.
Yes, here it is. Exactly. Yeah. So do you have holiday lights up?
No, I don't do that. We have the Christmas tree up because the boy was home for Thanksgiving. So we get the Christmas tree and I put the lights on it. Brought out the decorations, and those boxes of decorations have been right next to the tree since the Sunday after Thanksgiving. So the celebrities are, when you don't have little kids, it's just less of a priority. Like, you're like, oh yeah, I'll get to that. Like,
I know, we were, day after Thanksgiving, we were like, drive up to the Christmas tree farm, cut down the tree. You know,
no, we don't do that anymore.
You're like, I don't have little kids around to be like, you cut down the tree. You're just like,
the last time I cut down a tree, I was like doing the holding it in the middle thing, you know, and people look at it. And then we bring it home, or maybe I just got it to the car and I look and there was a poison ivy vine that was like all up the middle of it.
Oh, that's delightful.
Holding the whole time. And I'm very allergic to poison ivy. So,
oh no.
I was able to kind of just hold my hand up like this and scrubbed it off, and it wasn't a big deal. But I think that was the last time we cut down a tree. That wasn't entirely why, but it was like, you know what? There's easier ways. People,
you didn't have a Freddy Krueger hand.
Like, I did not have a Freddy Krueger hand.
That's good. That's good.
Oh yes, delightful. So, Chris Newmark, we've had quite a week.
Yeah, it's been quite a week.
Insane. And we've said this previously, recently on this podcast, quite a week, but this is quite a week. Like, this is quite
a week. My goodness. I mean, it's like, there's just no slowing down as, you know, the holidays approach. It's like, we're getting like a lot of big announcement out of medtech companies. I mean, there's just a lot of business and stuff to do before 2025 wraps up for the industry. I mean, I don't know. What do you think's up with that? Cause I mean, generally, in past years, for some reason, I remember December's being a little more sleepy. But
well, it's still early. I mean,
it's still early. That's true.
No,
got to get the business done.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know what the next 3 weeks are going to hold, but let's get into this news because there's a lot of good stuff. So let's roll into number 5.
Newmarker's newsmakers.
Newmarker's newsmakers.
Exactly, and you know, number 5 on the list. You know, this actually, this comes from our latest MedTech Markets Intelligence report that's available for sale on Mass Device. You know, it's already, this report was like pointing out like its main forecast in there is that for the overall market is that it's going to double in size by the end of the decade. Like, it's already worth billions of dollars. surgical robotics market is going to double in size. And I mean, which just goes along with, I mean, just everything we're seeing with surgical robotics. I mean, it's just so such an exciting dynamic space right now.
So are those in dollars invested or in revenues generated, or the whole kit and caboodle?
Whole kit and caboodle, like
Whole
the
kit and
value
caboodle.
of the entire market.
Yeah.
And you know, also Gail Grimes, the veteran analyst who made this nearly 100-page report. I mean, if you go and purchase that, download it. I mean, there's forecasts of like inside the U.S., outside the U.S., forecasts of how Intuitive is going to do and other major players that are in the space. So I mean, just a very extensive report on like all the different ways that surgical robotics is being used or could be used. So it's just if somebody just really wants to have just a really like high quality analysis report on the market, this is the way to go.
Well, we'll have to have Gail on an upcoming episode to talk about number two on the news. I don't want to spoil it, but I think people can guess what it is, but and
Yeah.
what the impact of that might be. So, all right. So, where can folks find the report again, Chris?
People could just go to the top of Mass Device in the top bar at the right. You'll see reports. Click on reports, and you can make your way over the robotic surgery report and download it. It's also available. The full URL is massdevice.com/products/robotic-surgery.
Yes. All right. Well, it's another great service provided to the medtech industry by the fine folks at Mass Device.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited about this. I mean, it's just like one more way we're really trying to inform people, across the industry, and hopefully, promote some more innovation.
I was thinking, Chris, I've been watching the Ken Burns series. Do you think when they do, he does or his descendant does a med tech series, they'll quote us? You think they'll have someone reading something we said in a podcast, or maybe they'll just play this audio and we'll be part of a future documentary done by Ken Burns number 7. What do you
And then Tom and Chris decided to start a
think? To very little fanfare. Number four.
Number four. People are like, what am I doing listening to this?
They're having fun.
We're going to inform you. Just hold on. All right, number four on the list. We've got the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. They provided a major reimbursement update for cardiac ablation technologies. They're including them, these AFib treating procedures now on their list of procedures covered at ambulatory surgery centers, which are just like this really fast growing area of healthcare. So I mean, this just really seems to be especially good news for any of the companies that are really competing right now with these next gen pulse field ablation technologies like Boston Scientific, Medtronic, Johnson and Johnson. And frankly, like good news for people who like need less invasive ways to treat AFib.
Absolutely. No, we've talked about ASCs a lot. We had Scott Fraser at Device Talks Boston, and we've had him on the podcast earlier. Clearly, this is the future for a lot of medical procedures. Obviously, not the most the most involved ones, but if you can go to a place with lots of parking, get in and out real quick, get your ticker fixed, why
Yeah.
wouldn't you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of like heading into a big giant hospital complex and whatnot, and like everything involved with that. Yeah, just very cool.
Do you think there's a code for getting your ticker fixed? Do you think if I plug that in, we get reimbursed?
I
Probably.
mean, you know, let's each call our health insurer after this and just ask them what the code is. My gosh, Tom, it's been a week. So, number three on the list. I mean, this is something
Yeah,
that
this one I'm
would
kicking myself about.
Yeah, we were on the show just the other week, with the news
Yep.
that Eric Todd had headed out on Stryker. We were like, he's gonna, ran Stryker's robotic surgery program. And we were like,
I'm
he's
such an
gonna
idiot. I mean, this would have been one to throw just to sound smart, like, woo, maybe he'll, but
maybe
no,
he'll do this,
it didn't even occur to me.
right? I mean, if it's not, if it doesn't happen, if it does happen, you look, yeah, exactly. Like,
exactly.
I mean,
Low hanging fruit. And we didn't
here, have it. Here he is. He's like, been announced as a CEO of Swan Endosurgical, which is the, you know, surgical robotics play that Olympus is doing in partnership with Revival Healthcare Capital. So, I mean, they've, you know, they've really brought in some like top talent to, you know, to run this new venture.
I've never, I mean, this is going to sound crazy, Chris, but Olympus is getting pretty sexy, pretty hot. I mean, they're coming out with a lot of big news, a lot of great stuff. It hasn't been something we've seen, you know, it's, and they've been working in this direction for a while, bringing on Bob White and now bringing on Eric Todd and Swan Endosurgical. I mean, this is an exciting company.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, I mean, they did have the reorg recently, but even that just seems like, you know, like just
everybody is
just gotta find. Yeah, exactly. Like get the company set up for, you know, what's coming in the future, you know? Yeah. But I mean, yeah, just all of these like milestones and, you know, strategic moves and, you know, just exciting to see, to see Olympus, like they're doing this venture, doing this play to, you know, to, you know, get much more involved in surgical robotics and bring on, you know, the person who's been running it over at Stryker, who should have some like really good knowledge of, you know, what surgeons actually want and need, that gets attention.
Absolutely. And there's so much news that we're actually having two number threes because they're both related to Stryker. And this is big news as well.
Yeah, this is big, really big news over at Stryker, which is Spencer Stiles has now been promoted to president and COO of the company. Which, I mean, generally, I mean, I think it's fair to say that this is often an indication of like who's being groomed to be the CEO. This is a way the company is kind of like giving indication to the outside world, like in the future, this is somebody who could you know, be CEO of the company. And so Spencer Stiles is now like in the president and COO spot.
Yep. No, and he and Andy Pierce, Spencer Stiles is in charge of the ortho mako sort of side. Andy Pierce is in charge of the neurovascular and kind of the non ortho side. Both were heads of equal divisions, so I don't know if there was any sort of trial of sorts, but it was clear that one of those two, I think, would have been in line for succession. And I think this just makes it, like you said, makes it clear. That being said, Kevin Lobo's 59, a few years older than I am, so still a very young man.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting that he may go anywhere, but I'm guessing this is something that investors and analysts like to see. Like, you know, you need to pick your successor and have that succession plan clear and in place. And who knows? Maybe it'll come sooner than we thought. But interesting pairing, though, with the Eric Todd news and then this elevation. And I don't know. I actually didn't. This happened just a few minutes ago. So is he keeping his titles as he's still leading orthopedic
No, he's he's not, like, so they the company elevated Dylan Crotty now to lead orthopedics over there. So I mean, this is really Styles like taking on like this this like overall, I mean, really like the number two person.
Styles succeeds by a couple of years Timothy Scannell, who retired in 2023. So.
Yeah, they had like a period really where there wasn't any COO of the company. So
big changes at Stryker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, this could have been any other week. This could be number one.
Yeah, totally.
But
it's
number
not.
Three, it's not, because number two is huge. Number one is huge.
Yeah. I mean, number two on the list. I mean, we finally have FDA approval of Medtronic's Hugo for an indication. The first one out the gate is urological. So there we go. Congratulations, Medtronic.
Yeah, no. Sean got that out very quickly yesterday. I posted just my wow post. Congratulations on LinkedIn last night. But just thinking about it, I mean, it just goes to show that medtech is hard, and you know, this has been a project that's been going on over for a decade, and we've talked with many great folks at Medtronic about it, about the potential of it, about, you know, we had talked with Rajit Kamel, we've talked with others over there about the program and waiting for the approval and to have it finally come forth. I can't imagine the joy that must come with that. After working on something for so long,
Rishi see something in, completed like that.
Yeah, absolutely. To see something completed and to see it get out, and to now it's go time. You and I, we've been talking about this in a theoretical sense, kind of like, you know, spring training. Who's going to be where? We've got our predicted standings for our respective sport, but now we get to watch the season. This is opening day. We've got a major med tech with a really massive surgical business that now has a robot, and let the games begin. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, the same times. Yeah, I mean, Intuitive. I mean, decades now in that space. You know, they've been the dominant company. A lot of like soft tissue surgical robotics inside hospitals in the U.S. I mean, Intuitive's been the company. I mean, I think that's the big open question. Like, I mean, Medtronic is a giant company, as you said. They've got a giant surgical business. Can they, can they compete against Intuitive in this space? And we'll watch and we'll see how it goes. But you're right. It's like let the season begin.
Yep. All right. Well, congratulations to everyone at Medtronic for that. They're of course. Headquarters for the surgical robot is in Boston. So
Proud you just of that. Had to mention that, right?
we enjoyed a visit over there a couple of years ago at Device Talks Boston. Yep. Got to play with Hugo. And it was very cool. So it's nice to have the good news here. So
see that circle around and see it approved. I mean, yeah, just a lot of work to get a system like that approved. So
absolutely. All right. And number one as well.
I know this, I mean, Medtronic Hugo would have,
you could have gone 1-2, either one, I think could have been one. Like, I don't think he's a clear one or two here.
There really isn't. I mean, this is, number one on the list. This was, a nice little a good scoop that we had, that senior editor Sean Hooley ran out yesterday that Johnson & Johnson MedTech, they're going to be, there's like another, like, you know, big organizational restructuring that is kicking off over there, where they're going to be shifting to having this business unit led structure, they're actually kicking this off on January 1st. So they're, kind of moving away from this model of having, people running different regions of the world. And they're really like folk having it more like the businesses inside J&J MedTech do that.
Mm-hmm.
Except for China. You don't want to mess with China, I guess. Like solely. But
Yep. No, I mean, it follows. I think we've seen similar reorgs at other companies. You mentioned Olympus earlier. I'm not sure if it's exactly this way, but this sounds like a Stryker setup. The Smith and Nephew went through something, I was reminded, a couple of years ago, and it helped a lot. And it makes sense. And we had Tim Schmidt at Device Talks West after the Pew Synthes spin out.
Right. I mean, they're spinning out the Pew Synthes, and they even in the internal, message of J&J that we acquired, they were even mentioning that spinoff, that this was kind of like a good time to do something like this as they kind of simplify the organization.
I mean, Sean had reached out to J&J and a spokesperson said, Johnson & Johnson MedTech is dedicated to improving the lives of a million of people around the world. To strengthen that commitment, we have updated our organizational structure to create a simpler, faster, and more competitive organization that can better serve patients and customers. We are moving businesses from a regional model to a business unit-led structure. This will increase specialty focus, streamline decision-making, and deliver better clinical and commercial outcomes for the people and healthcare providers we serve. So,
that's... I mean, they've had some exciting stuff going on with cardiology as well. Mm-hmm. Actually, just in a, people should keep an eye out on Mass Device. Just in 2 weeks, we're going to have a gated free special report about the cardiology devices market. And I ranked the top five companies. And I mean, all five of them, including J&J, I mean, cardiology is just really, all these cardiology devices are really the growth drivers right now. So, I mean, J&J wants to, really likes the growth in cardiology, wants to focus on that. And then, the surgical business, I mean, they've got Atava under development. So, I mean, Medtronic's out there with Hugo, and, J&J wants to get, follow up and get Atava out there as well. So we're going to have big companies competing against Intuitive.
Yep. It's no market, great list. There's much, much more, right, at Mass Device. Folks need to check that on the hour, I think.
Yeah. For all things MedTech, go to massdevice.com. And really, I encourage you, like, sign up for our daily e-newsletter. I mean, that's like a great way to get a, just get a nice, you know, nice email in your inbox with a, you know, really up to date, like top five, you know, MedTech stories of the day. And, you know, and frankly, it's the most timely news you're going to get. I always love like a lot of the other outfits that put out those types of emails. I like reading the stuff we covered about like I see it in the next day in their newsletter.
Now, Chris Neubarger.
Sorry, I should got to talk a little smack. Got to talk.
No, smack
talk
is
up.
Good. Smack. Yeah, smack is good. All right, man. Good job.
All right, man. Take care, buddy.
All right, Chris Neubarger. Thanks so much for the newsmakers. Now I'd like to hand the microphone over to our Device Talks managing editor, Kayleen Brown. She's visiting with our sponsor, Resonetics.
Eric Veit, VP of Business Development for Nitinol at Resonetics. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Kayleen. I appreciate being here. Thanks for having us.
So I've had the pleasure of sitting down with several members of Resonetics, but if you don't mind, Eric, can you remind us how Resonetics supports medical device companies and how you work with Nitinol and components?
Resonetics is really known as experts in the micro manufacturing area. We support interventional, advanced surgery, advanced diagnostics, and bioelectronics. And Nitinol fits into that in a lot of areas, mostly in the interventional and advanced surgery side, and looking toward the future a little bit on the advanced diagnostics and bioelectronics side of things.
Great. Can you take us through a focus on how Resonetics works with Nitinol?
We're a full service provider in Nitinol. We're totally integrated. We make our own melt. And we take that all the way through, we call it melt to market. So we, from the melt side all the way to the market, as in the market being advanced components, both delivery components and implantable components like heart valves or electrophysiology components.
So that was a really good overview. Can you help us understand maybe how you work directly with medical device companies?
We work with everybody from startups through multinational large corporations. And we work initially with the R&D departments and prototyping. We have what we call Lightspeed Lab, which is our rapid prototyping group. They turn quotes around in a day, turn parts around in a week to 2 weeks. And that really gives us a leg up to work with these R&D departments, prototype parts, and get those moving toward production. Our goal eventually is to produce those parts in a high volume environment. And so we are set up to do that by making our own equipment. And we have a whole team that works on transferring projects into production.
All right, we'll take a quick break from this conversation with our sponsor, Resonetics, to bring in our FOMO. But first, if you need more information about Resonetics, go to its website, resonetics.com. That's resonetics.com. Now let's hear this conversation between Jim Hambrand, he's managing editor of our Medical Design and Outsourcing magazine, and Ken Charhut, the CEO of Foldax.
Hello, I'm Jim Hamrand, Managing Editor of Medical Design Outsourcing. We're at Device Talks West in Santa Clara, California, recording some FOMO clips for Device Talks podcast. And right now I have the pleasure of speaking with Foldax CEO, Ken Charhut. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today.
So Jim, thanks for inviting me here and happy to share what we're doing at Foldax, and hopefully your audience will gain something from it.
Oh, of course. It's so exciting. You've got so much going on the valve and the delivery and the automation, the manufacturing automation. So let's start at a high level. What drew you to structural heart?
So I was in structural heart in my years at Baxter, mm-hmm. for whatever. And then I actually jumped out into startups for about 20 years while the structural heart area kind of grew more. And then I think I saw a convergence opportunity, which brought me back in. It obviously is something that, you know, it was very important to me in my years at Baxter. And I was just looking at a way to kind of sneak back in to it.
What are your views on the main or the principal challenges right now facing the structural heart market?
Yeah, well, I think the whole structural heart market really came about because of the delivery of the technology, mm-hmm. right? And to be able to take it out of the operating room, put it into the cath lab, and reduce the morbidity of the process. And so that really was a long kind of arm that developed, became possible. Mm-hmm. Nitinol as a material really, which led that to a thing, although, cobalt chromium is probably the leading implant that's left in there. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, this compressible technology is really what allowed that delivery system to happen. And so all of a sudden, possibilities for all the valves in the heart became, and structural heart became a way to do it. And a lot of what was done in the operating can now be done in there. It's procedural, it's morbidity. It's not really what's left behind, per se, in most cases. And so I always, because I was selling into the surgery and a lot of the valves there, saw kind of the need for what's left behind for the patients that's still there, and that while solving how it gets there, we didn't solve that. So, the ability to bring those two together and solve two problems at once is, what excited me to get back in it.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about those technical advances that are solving this problem.
So on the, clearly it's that compressible material, nitinol or whatever, mm-hmm. on the delivery side, which allowed you to deliver it, through the arteries instead of opening up the chest to get there.
Right. Crimp it down in the catheter, get in that self-expansion.
Get it in, and then all the, and all the materials required to deliver it, position it, get it in there. That was a long thing. But on the other side, you were still faced with what were you going to leave behind? You either had to leave tissue behind because you couldn't really use the alternative, which was surgical, which is pyrolytic carbon mechanical valves, which are non-compressible. And so, that left them out. So your only alternative at the time was tissue. But tissue has a durability problem. And so if you look at the progression of the entire structure hot field, it started with very elderly, very sick people, and has come down. And still, as you get to this 70, 65 age, what's appropriate, and you begin hearing things like valve and valve, using two in your life, maybe a surgical, then something, but two operations, right? And it's almost not solving that morbidity problem because you're asking the patient to do something twice. So move over to material side. All right, take that, but now move over to the leaflet side. And, Foldax has been working on, a polymeric solution. So not pyrolytic carbon, not tissue, but polymeric, where you can get the best of both. You can get the lifestyle that you get with a tissue valve, no anticoagulation or low anticoagulation, and you can get the longevity, the durability that you get with the pyrolytic carbon. So those 70, 68, 60, 50, can take the benefit of both of those.
Yeah.
Right.
So how does an innovation like that then spread across the industry in the near term?
So in the near term, it's no one's done it before, mm-hmm. right? And I guess, the third addition that we have to this is we're using robots to manufacture instead of lots and lots of highly skilled people.
Right.
Like the
one day deploying pods to manufacture at scale.
So we're taking the whole manufacturing process, changing it. We're introducing a new material for a long time, and there's no predicate. There's no one else has done it. So it's us persevering, moving forward. So what's in the near term? Us.
Yeah. And how does that, what kind of innovation then does that set off at your competitors in the near term now that you've got that?
Well, so it's 40 years of trying for polymers. So we feel somewhat lucky. Obviously, there's a lot of really, really smart people that went into that. To have something that's progressed into the clinic. We have, people with our implanted device for over 6 years now. We have commercial approval outside of the U.S. for the device. So we're really moving the experience ahead for the thing. And while we see lots and lots of innovation on that delivery side and what can happen on the delivery, where it can go, on another polymer company, not a lot. It's a tough road to hoe. And so I think we're just building a big advantage. And as we succeed and people see you can succeed, I would expect a lot more. You hear a lot of people talking about it, but actually doing it, I think we're way out in front in terms of that.
Sounds like you've solved this problem. Are there other big problems out there that you would love to be able to solve, or that you're hoping somebody else out there can solve in structural heart?
Well, I think, on the... I don't know that we've totally solved that. So, maybe, as anything progresses, someone will be smarter than us, will take the field forward. But what we'll do is we'll transform the entire platform of how you think about a heart valve, how you think about making it, right? So there's people, working on AI. So we do most of our stuff right off the computer into making a valve, mm-hmm. right? But what size valve for that patient? How do you do that? So through imaging, through AI, there's a whole, group of technology and technologists that are trying to address that problem. If you can give me the exact specifications, right, I can take it in. I can start making the valves for individual patients for individual size, so we don't just put stuff on the shelf, but we're actually, we're making your valve.
Tailor-made, yeah.
Tailor-made for you.
Exactly. Well, paint me a picture then. In 5-10 years, what does the structural heart market look like?
Well, I hope with the delivery system advances in 5 to 10 years mm-hmm. that you're able to deliver to all the major valves, right? So the aortic, the tricuspid, the mitral valve, and in a truly less invasive manner. Mm-hmm. Some of the technology right now attacking some of the other valves has a lot of room for improvement in terms of how they squash down, how small they are to get in there. And so I'd hope that that problem gets solved. And there's a company called Myris that's out there right now, and they're using a new unique metal, mm-hmm. and it's allowing them to configure the stent structure in a different way, such that they can really lower the profile mm-hmm. of the implant. So 5 years from now, if they're successful, you may not be having expandable sheaths, which they have right now, which are something that's 16 French, but actually is going to 24 French. Maybe you really deliver just 16 French, and get to the end. If you can get it to like 12 French, it's a huge morbidity reduction for patients. And it truly becomes almost a walk-in, walk-out, kind of procedure. And if you're walking out with something polymeric, that's going to last for a long time.
You're not going back.
What would that world look like? And I don't, it's not that. It's probably not that far away mm-hmm. with all the smart people looking at it.
Well, that's so exciting. Such a great industry to be in med tech, isn't it?
It really is. It is, because at the end of the day, it's somebody's life that you're changing, that the experience that you're making. It's a doctor or more doctors who are capable of providing care to patients. And in our case, not asking for more money to do it. So addressing the healthcare costs. So, it's just a very positive industry to be in, to work in, but, highly challenging.
Well, thank you for the work that you do in this industry to advance patient care. I really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your insights with us here today.
Oh, I appreciate it. And thank you for allowing me to share them.
All right, Foldax is a really fascinating company. Thank you, Ken Charhut, for joining us on FOMO. Great job by Jim Hammerhead. And now it's time for our keynote conversation. Chris Newmarker, editor-in-chief of Mass Advice, talked with Alan Chang. Dr. Alan Chang, he's the chief medical officer of Medtronic's cardiac rhythm management business. Let's listen.
Hi there, this is Chris Newmarker. I'm editor-in-chief of Mass Device and Medical Design Outsourcing and co-host of the Device Talks weekly podcast. We're increasingly living in a world where consumer tech devices can provide a constant stream of health data. For example, my Fitbit isn't anything special, Versa 4, but it's telling me right now that I have a heart rate of 91. I mean, that's not bad for, you know, like resting, I guess, on, you know, midday on, you know, on a Monday. But, you know, there could be important differences, though, between what consumer devices can do and the capabilities of medical grade cardiac monitors made by companies such as medtech giant Medtronic. To discuss, I'm happy to have on Dr. Alan Chang. Dr. Chang is a practicing electrophysiologist who is a chief medical officer of Medtronic's cardiac rhythm management business. Dr. Chen, welcome to Device Talks Weekly.
Hey, Chris. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite.
That's fantastic. Well, I guess just, you know, to start out, I'd like just to ask you, like, what's your story? I mean, how did you get into Medtronic, like MedTech and Medtronic?
Yeah, in short, serendipitously, to be honest with you. I've been with Medtronic now just a little over 9 years now. And to your point, prior to that, I was on faculty at Johns Hopkins as a practicing cardiac electrophysiologist and associate professor of medicine there. Did the research, saw the patients, taught at the med school kind of thing. And one thing happened to another. They gave me an opportunity to expand the work I was doing and the impact I was having. And I took the leap and joined. And I guess 9 years into it, the rest is history.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So kind of like working on the innovations, at Johns Hopkins, of course, like one of the top health providers in the world. And then, you know, you kind of like saw this opportunity to get more involved in like the technology that you were working at there and to help further the innovation. So that's fantastic. And I mean, being at Medtronic, I mean, so as I said, like people are kind of used to like what their Apple Watches or their Fitbits could do or whatnot. But I mean, maybe give people like a quick overview. I mean, what are like these, medical grade, you know, cardiac monitor technologies that a company such as Medtronic offers, including like there's the Link insertable cardiac monitors.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, maybe just to take a step back to your point, I mean, these wearable devices that provide some type of health-based information, I you can see this, it's exploding everywhere. It's becoming the big trend that people are more accustomed to. Quite honestly, it's sort of akin to back in the very, very old days, probably before your and my time, you know, scales came into being, right? Where you people were weigh themselves all, as opposed to having to go to clinic and doing that. This is a very similar sort of modern day version of a scale where people are getting more aware of their own health. And it's a great thing. I think the challenge is very often when you get health information from these type of consumer-based platforms, there is an expectation that it's necessary for what ails you. And what we've come to appreciate is that some of these monitoring devices, especially when you're managing medical conditions or diagnoses, such as abnormal arrhythmias like atrial fibrillation or things of that like, you really need medical grade technology to provide that sensitivity and the specificity, if you will, of the information you're gathering from your bodies to make really important decisions about your health and what you need to do and what you shouldn't do.
I mean, give me an example. What is something that a medical grade wearable or medical grade heart tracker could catch that, you know, an Apple Watch or a Fitbit or whatnot wouldn't be able to catch?
Yeah. So as an example, our Link devices are these implantable cardiac monitors that we introduced in the late 90s, early 2000 range. And these devices were designed to measure heart rhythms and to track heart rhythms and to detect any abnormal heart rhythms that could be occurring. Now, these other watches and these Ring platforms, they do all the same things, or at least they try to do all the same things, but they're not tuned to the sensitivity of being able to pick up everything. And if I can give you just one example, Chris, we had a very a sub-analysis of a larger study that we had done that we presented on about a year or so ago, showing that people who had an Apple Watch on, as well as these implantable Link devices, the Apple Watch only picked up about 40% of the episodes that the Link device captured. Wow. And that was probably due to variations in the way they're being used. Sometimes they have to take it off to shower, or they have to take it off to recharge the device, things like that. But even in the context of someone wearing the watch while they had this Link device in place, the watch only captured about 26% of the events that the Link device captured. And it really speaks to the notion about how sensitive certain platforms are, consumer-grade devices, medical-grade devices. And so what I tell folks is, look, if you've got a medical condition that you're really managing, it's really important that you use medical-grade devices so that you can get the assurance that if there is something to pick up, the device will pick it up.
Are you seeing anything worrying out there with health providers, you know, saying, you know, like I don't know if my patients need something like a Link monitor or whatnot. You know, maybe I think their watches are just fine, or like, you know, tracking what they have or whatnot. I mean, is there any, you know, potential challenge there we need to work through, or?
Yeah, it's a great question. I haven't seen anything yet from the healthcare provider perspective, but from the patient side, I think that's where, you know, some hesitancy or some scrutiny should be exercised, because if folks buy this consumer grade monitor and they expect that they're going to be able to get the same performance as a medical grade device, then they might put all their eggs in that basket and say, if there's no news that I've got an arrhythmia, then that's good news. And that might not necessarily be the right conclusion, because these devices are just tuned differently to be able to pick up some things versus others.
So it sounds like maybe there needs to be more of a message like, hey, if you're occasionally experiencing like a chest pain, you know, a slight chest pain, you shouldn't be like, well, my watch doesn't, you know, show me having an arrhythmia. I'm fine. I'm going to keep on, you know, going here. Like you need to get in and get things checked out more, because these things aren't medical grade.
Yeah, I think the standing recommendation of talk to your doctor or your clinician still holds, despite you maybe having some information that you've collected on your own from these consumer grade devices that you've purchased.
Now, what are the consumer devices good for? I mean, because in my head, I'm kind of thinking like, you know, these could, you know, enable more adoption of medical grade wearables, perhaps, because maybe they're going to spot things that people otherwise wouldn't spot, and then you know, they can work with their doctor to get stuff, you know, monitored even more fully. Could these potentially be useful in like spotting AFib cases or whatever that we might not know about?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's two things that the consumer grade devices are great for. One is just breath of exposure, right? I mean, you are not going to get the same number of people having a Link as you would, say, with an Apple Watch or a Ring or any of these other platforms that people can more readily get access to, because the access point is a lower barrier. The other piece of this, I think, in many regards, with these consumer grade devices, is they collect other information as well, right? It's not just about heart rhythms, for example. It's about sleep cycles. It's about other sort of things that might be indicative of your overall health status. And so anytime you do anything to generate more awareness or accountability of someone's health, it's a good thing. Again, going back to our example of the weight scale that you can put at home, people who have scales have been shown to lose weight. There's nothing that the scale is necessarily doing per se to help you lose weight, but that awareness and that reminding of it really goes a long way with regard to promoting preventive health and overall health benefits.
Yeah, I know. I mean, totally. I'd say with my Fitbit, just knowing how many steps I'm taking a day is useful. You know, it's information I wouldn't have had before. Like, have I moved around a lot today? Have I not? You know, and I could see too what you're saying about sleep tracking. I mean, kind of that relationship we see between, you know, potential heart problems and whatnot and COPD and sleep problems. Like being able to catch that could be super useful as well. And just even like if these, you know, devices go off sometimes and tell people that you're having an AFib episode or whatnot. I still remember, what was it, years ago, there was that Minneapolis miracle where, the ball was caught in that playoff game, and I remember there was like a AFib alerts going off or something around the Twin Cities. Or
I wouldn't doubt it.
It's like half the city's heart stopped just at the same time. Briefly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so, okay, so So it seems like basically like don't rely on these if you really need to know like, you know, how your heart health is. So then like going to like, okay, you need to get, you know, medical grade wearables. I mean, what's the kind of the breadth of what's available now? I mean, because it seems like we've moved a far way off from technologically from like sending people home with like a holder monitor on them, you know, with all these, you know, ECG pads. What's available at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, much of it is still focused on measuring heart rhythms, if you will, and measuring electrocardiograms or the electrical signatures that the heart emits. Just to give us a sense of what heart rhythms people are experiencing, you know, how slow or how fast heart rhythms are. But the next phase in this that we've gravitated toward is really looking at ways in which artificial intelligence can help curate this information, but will also help us understand how best to interpret some of this information.
Wow.
Now, one of the consequences of having some of these devices, and this is probably true across the board within these implantable medical grade devices, is that they're very sensitive in picking up signals. And by definition, when you're super sensitive in picking up signals, sometimes you might be picking up false signals, if you will. And you might get information that might not even be applicable or useful. And so what we've done with our Link platform is apply a good amount of artificial intelligence or AI-based algorithms to help reduce these false alerts to the point where clinicians can now really just focus on what really matters, those real signals, and then maintaining that level of sensitivity. And so this last iteration of these AI algorithms that we've incorporated have actually reduced the amount of false alerts by more than 90%. And that has saved a tremendous amount of time to these clinicians in managing more and more patients that get online and require this type of help.
Going to cut in here really quickly to bring you the conclusion of my conversation with this episode's sponsor, Eric Veit, VP of Business Development for Nitinol at Resonetics. So I understand how Resonetics is working with Nitinol, but how is Resonetics different compared to other component suppliers?
I think what's different is that we're really working to be a world-class partner. We want to partner with companies to be able to provide raw material, component processing, high volume manufacturing, soup to nuts. We do it, we cover it, we want to work with them. And we do that through a backbone of science. So we have a backbone, which we call our advanced technology group, and they're technical experts down to the material science level, you know, down to the microstructure of the Nitinol and how that's impacted by processing it, how to optimize it, how to get the best out of your performance of your parts. And that's what we offer, and that's what we enjoy doing every day.
Perfect. Let's look to the future. So how do you see Nitinol being used in the future in terms of component applications?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, wrote a post recently called Nitinol Through the Decades on LinkedIn, and gives you a kind of decade by decade breakdown of some of the parts that were are made. And looking in the future, there's right now you can't really 3D print Nitinol. There's experimentation that you can 3D print it, but I think for the future, those things will get worked out, and for orthopedic applications, you know, you'll be able to use it. There's passive and active microelectronic implantables. You know, you have heart failure is definitely an area that's up and coming, and the use of devices there. And then if you combine sensors with batteries, like the Synchron neurological implants that will have sensors and batteries implanted, be able to both monitor brain function and also change it. I think those are applications of the future. And then from an AI perspective, actually in the process, not the component side, but that would be things like using artificial intelligence to data, for example, on heat treatment. You know, if you we've already started doing this where we're incorporating our knowledge of heat treatment and creating AI models where the number of steps, the outputs that you want, the AF temperature, the final, that the number of the heat treatment temperatures, all that's put into the model. And it's kind of creating a smart engineer for anybody. You know, it makes the average engineer into a technical fellow. You know, of course, it's just like ChatGPT, you got to check it, but it gets you, you know, gets you halfway there.
That's a lot to look forward to in the future. And I think I'm going to have to 100% put that LinkedIn post link here in the show notes, because I'm sure my audience would be very interested to learn about Nightingale through the decades. So for our audience, please take a look right there. Eric, VP of Business Development for Nightingale at Resonetics, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, giving me a little update on Nightingale and what we can expect from it to come. So thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Kayleen. I appreciate the time.
Huge thanks to Resonetics for sponsoring this episode of Abbott Talks. We really can't tell these important stories without your support. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And to our audience, to learn how you can work with Resonetics and learn more about Nightingale, please visit their website, www.resonetics.com, resonetics.com. Thanks again.
So it's kind of like you're seeing the AI. So what I'm hearing you saying is that the AI is kind of like helping to point out patterns in the data that, you know, the physicians just wouldn't otherwise have time to look at. Because I mean, it's great. You have time to talk to me right now, and a lot of physicians are incredibly busy people. I mean, I find so. I mean, having time to go through like data and pinpoint things, but the AI can help them out. So
yeah, and you could just imagine the amount of data that people are talking about. I mean, I don't have numbers, but if, you know, if they're recording each of these episodes, because these Link devices are monitoring the heart 24/7, and they're recording any periods where they feel like the heart's gone too slow, or it's gone too fast, or there's pauses or complex arrhythmias, that really amounts to a lot of data. And you know, any assistance or any facilitation of removing the things that are not important, I think goes a long way in just the normal day-to-day workflow of these clinicians.
How is, just to back up really quick for people who aren't aware from it, I mean, I know Link's been around for about 10 years. It's, you know, this implantable like monitor. Where exactly does it go in the heart?
It's been around for actually almost 2 decades, if not longer than that, since our first inception of it. So these things have been designed to facilitate pretty straightforward insertion. And so what typically is done is the left side of the heart, just above the nipple and to the left side of the breastbone, is an area that most clinicians clean off and sterilize. They put a little numbing medicine in that area, and they make a little nick in the skin, which is about a quarter to half of an inch wide. And then there's a special tool with this device that's already preloaded, and you basically just insert it with just like a plunger kind of approach.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so it's very straightforward. You literally can do this within minutes, not exaggerating. And the incision or the nick is so small in most cases, if not all cases, you don't even need stitches. You just put a bunch of Steri-Strips over it and you go home that same day. And so
sounds like this can just be done in the clinician's office then.
That's right.
Super easy. Yeah.
In fact, it is. And I think the procedure has gotten so refined that you don't need to be just a physician to do it. We're hearing a lot of nurse practitioners, these allied health professionals taking part in this process as well, because it's been designed to be easier in terms of implanting this thing.
Yeah, and then the data from it gets transmitted to a transmitter or an app on a mobile phone, then to go up to the cloud to the health providers.
That's exactly right. So there's a wireless transmission that goes to a base station that all of these patients get, or other types of communication, and then that gets transmitted to a server where all the information is collected, and then the clinics have access to that because it's their data, and so they can easily pick up on Mr. Smith's information whenever it's needed. The other part of this also is the system is designed to alert physicians and clinicians about critical events. This data gets downloaded on a periodic basis, and if it sees anything, it'll alert the clinicians to contact the patient as necessary.
Wow. That's great. So it's kind of like your doctor can, that doctor's office can reach out to you and say, like, hey, we're noticing a trend we don't like here. We want you to, come here and get checked out more, basically.
That's right.
That's fantastic. So, and that's neat that, putting AI to bear on this, could hopefully, pinpoint some more trends that otherwise would never be caught. So, I mean, what kind of data do you have at this point about how Link can basically reduce adverse events, reduce hospitalizations or whatnot?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we're still investigating ways in which we can use Link to come out with some reduction in hospitalization outcomes and things of that sort. But one sort of application of Link nowadays has been in detecting atrial fibrillation. Now, atrial fibrillation is the most common arrhythmia that people experience, and it increases as you get older. And there's some other risk factors like high blood pressure and thyroid disease that come with it as well. But what's important to know about atrial fibrillation is that it's strongly associated with strokes. And so in folks who have had atrial fibrillation detected, there's a conversation that's had with the clinician and the patient about whether they need to take preventive measures to reduce that person's risk for stroke. But also in kind, people who've had strokes, currently the clinical practice guidelines would recommend monitoring for the presence of atrial fibrillation. And if you do have that, then enact the appropriate measures like medications or whatnot to reduce the risk for subsequent strokes in the future. So there's direct applications, direct ways in which the Link can help with patient outcomes.
And like lead to ablation procedures, and we're increasingly seeing advances with that technology. I mean, what Medtronic has with Affera and other pulse field ablation systems. So it's fantastic.
That's right.
I mean, do you think it's going to help? How much is it helping to you kind of decode the relationship between, say, like AFib and COPD or sleep apnea, or how is that helping out with that?
That's the hope, right? There's nothing concrete, but the hope is to try to utilize these medical grade devices implanted in the right underneath the skin to see if there's other opportunities to pick up on signals that might, to your point, decode other conditions. But there's nothing that I've seen so far that's been published on that or anything like that. But hopefully,
it could be something in the future. Yeah,
something in the future. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's exciting. So at this point, generally in the United States, if someone's going to a health provider, raising some questions about their heart health, when would health providers in the United States generally talk with them about a Link monitor being an option?
Yeah. So the current indication for a Link is really to use it in anyone who's at risk for an arrhythmia. And that's been the general sort of indicated language that the FDA has approved this device to use it on. And so, I think you step back and say, well, you know, when does someone have a risk of these type of arrhythmias? And the most common symptoms people experience are, you know, feeling like you've had palpitations or some, you know, fish flopping in your chest or some rapid beating sensation in your chest that you don't quite know what it is. And so that's when clinicians start to think about ways in which you would want to do monitoring, because at the end of the day, what the link is trying to do is help with establishing what we call a symptom rhythm correlation. You know, when you have symptoms that you think may be related to your heart or some abnormal rhythm, you need to correlate what your heart rhythms are doing at that time, because sometimes it may not even be related to your heart. It may have been a little muscle spasm of some sort in your chest that caused you feeling that way. And so the link is great because it provides that 24/7 monitoring, and the battery lasts for more than 4 years. Wow. And so you've got the ability to just keep an eye on it, even if, you know, your symptoms happen, let's say once every 6 months or once every year, where some of these Holter monitors or these wearables, it's really difficult to be monitoring for that period, long period of time. These link devices, right, you just set it and effectively forget it, and it'll be there to pick up what heart rhythms are happening when you have your next episode of symptoms.
So, I mean, is there enough interest in this idea that, hey, you know, you could be monitoring this for a few years versus, as you said, like a Holter monitor, it's a few weeks, or you know, these wearables now, like such as like iRhythm or Bardy DX or whatever, that's like a few weeks, you know, that you're, yep, having this patch on. Like you're saying, like, hey, you could have this like pretty minimally invasive procedure, have this, you know, monitor above your breastbone for like up to 4 years, you know, to track things. When are doctors saying like, yes, I want to do that, I want to track this for 4 years?
Yeah, and most clinicians actually view this as the thing they want to do, and sometimes, you know, payers, yeah, have some restrictions on what they can or cannot do based on, you know, some folks require some type of Holter monitor done first, and then you get the link. So there's some nuances about that, but I think, yeah, in a ideal world, I think most people would want to just gravitate to this solution because, to your point, you just do it once and you're done for several years.
So this question might be really out there, but is there any potential in the future that, you know, something like the link could be over the counter even? I mean, if it's so minimally invasive, that, I mean, are there people who'd be like, yeah, I'll spend, I mean, if it's a few hundred dollars, you know what, I'll spend for this. I want this tracked, you know, somebody's saying I'm getting on my years. I want to get this type of stuff tracked.
I love the question. I mean, the end of the day, I don't know, but yeah, it's an intriguing idea.
It is. I mean, yeah. Especially we're seeing that with CGMs. I mean, you know, they're going more over the counter. So
I never say never, Chris.
Never say never. You know, so at least for now, it's like, yeah, this is like, you know, something that you know, health provider has to do with you. It gets covered by insurance. You know, how then do you see like something like Link interacting with all these consumer devices out there? Because people, you know, somebody might have a Link, but, you know, they'll, you know, still have a smartwatch and they'll, you know, still be, yeah, maybe tracking steps, or, you know, maybe they even, you know, have a CGM or whatnot. I mean, how does it interact with all this stuff?
I see them as complementary at this point in time, where, yeah, you know, these Links are tuned to do a specific task now and to do that one task well. And many of these other consumer grade devices provide complementary information to what, for example, the Link does not capture. And you may not need that level of sensitivity to capture what your sleep cycles are, for example, or your temperature, your body temperature, things like that. And so right now, for folks that are very tuned to wanting to understand overall health, wellness, and whatnot, these consumer grade devices are sufficient for that. But when it results in a medical condition or a medical diagnosis that really requires more refined sensitivity and specificity in managing that, mm-hmm, that's when you really need to talk to your doctor about something like a Link, because that's where these devices are designed to do and perform it.
One interesting thing I'm thinking of is like we're at Mass Device starting to report about more wearable blood pressure devices coming. I mean, that's been kind of like one of the big holy grails of digital health is to, yeah, you know, not to have, you know, and
I mean, they aren't, as far as I know, I don't see them listed yet on, you know, the AMA's list of like approved devices, but we're starting to see some movement on them. I mean, how interesting could that be? Like, if, you know, people can more regularly track their blood pressure, and then you can, you know, see, you know, like the link data, like how their heart's performing at the same time.
I think it's great. I mean, I think it would be very interesting, because if you think about high blood pressure or hypertension as a condition, a large portion of people are not controlled. And you know, any effort to try to get more awareness of where their blood pressure is and how often they're in controlled sort of pressures, I think would only help with reducing all of the outcomes that are associated with high blood pressure, like strokes and heart attacks and heart failure, right, and that sort. So, you know, there's a ton of interest in this. I think the sky's the limit with regard to how things are going to evolve, especially given the way technology is advancing now. It reminds me of Star Trek. You know, some of the things that we once thought, right, were fantasy are becoming reality. And I wouldn't doubt that this would be something like that for blood pressure monitoring as well.
And at the tricorder level with all this stuff, that'd be great. Right. So, you know, and yeah, it is exciting, like how you could like really like figure out some more things, like, oh, your AFib is better when you have a 10,000 to 20,000 step day, and your blood pressure is more at this level versus, right, like these other days, and like there could be some really, really cool insights to find. So I love everything we've spoken about here. Like, before we run, I mean, one thing I'd really like to just hear is, like, I mean, what's next? I mean, what has you excited for the future?
There's a lot of stuff that's going on. I wish I can tell you all of that in the last 30 seconds we've got here, but this is you know, if you think about electrophysiology as the field, right, if you will, and you think back, or you look back in the last 50 or 60 years, there have been epochs of transformational times. And we are, frankly, at an inflection point in the next era of electrophysiology right now. You take a look at, you mentioned this earlier, the adoption of pulse field ablation, the leadless pacemaker technology that we introduced and is growing in leaps and bounds. And then this AI based diagnostic algorithm process that we're putting into our links. The sky has just been opened up and expanded with regard to things that we can do, questions that we couldn't answer in the past that we can answer now, and then thinking about just the next leap up. And so we're entering another phase, another era of electrophysiology, where I think there's just going to be significant advancements made both in technology and the way we care for patients.
That's fantastic. I mean, just one quick example. I mean, how could, like, the way we're caring for, you know, patients now be improved a lot because of these advancements?
Well, I think, for one, there's been a lot of talk about throughput in clinics, for example, and it takes forever to get to see a physician, or it takes forever to see a clinician and follow up and whatnot. Some of these AI models are refining themselves to a point where they can probably answer a lot of the things that you could get answered without, wow, seeing a patient, physician, if you will. There's also been a lot of conversation about more home-based care. Do you have to go to the hospital for everything you need to get done? Can, yeah, you do some of that? Like, somebody gets hospitalized nowadays for, let's say, a soft tissue infection, and they need to get antibiotics intravenously. Can that actually still happen at home? Can that be in a defragmented kind of situation? And all this technology that we're talking about that's evolving is going to provide you the capability of doing that. You don't have to be in the hospital to be monitored. You could potentially be monitored at home. You can get your treatment and your medications at home, all those sort of things. And so there's a lot of excitement around, what does healthcare delivery look like in the next couple, yeah, of decades? And it looks like people are gravitating more to a defragmented or a fragmented kind of model, where you don't necessarily have to go to the hospital for everything you need.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I could see, like, most people, if you had the choice, they could come and bring the care to you versus, like, having to eat hospital food. That sounds like sounds like a good plan, you know. It sounds like you weren't there at this point, but in the future, like, hopefully in maybe even years, like, we could be at a point where, like, if you have a medical grade wearable like a link, and you're wondering, do I need to go to the ER? Do I need to go to the hospital? Like, you could have an AI kind of like give you an idea of like help you game out what you actually need to do.
For sure. It's within the possibilities.
That's fantastic. Well, Dr. Cheng, it was a real pleasure. Thanks again for appearing on Device Talks Weekly.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast. Thanks so much to our sponsor, Resonetics. Resonetics has been a fantastic, steady, and strong supporter of Device Talks, and we are really grateful. If you don't want to miss a future episode of the Device Talks Weekly podcast or our other podcasts, please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network. Please also make sure you connect with Device Talks on LinkedIn. Follow Device Talks. Follow Mass Device. Connect with me. Connect with Kayleen Brown. Connect with Chris Newmarker. Connect with Jim Hammerand. We'd love to be part of your future MedTech conversations. And don't forget to join us on December 9th at our final Device Talks Tuesdays of the year. And go to devicetalks.com for more information. Thanks, everybody. Look forward to talking to you next week.